my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
And coming back on the podcast about a year after his debut appearance, Tao Gegenhart. Tao.
Afternoon, Richard.
Hello, thank you for coming and joining us again in your native Hackney.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis, we've got the big talking points covered.
Lionel, where are we?
We're in Tao's native Hackney, in the London Fields Brewery. I'm having a paper cup of tea, which is probably not the drink of choice. Richard's having a beer, so expect all the feisty comments from him today.
Thank you, Lionel. So, Tao, we've got a lot of questions for you, not just from ourselves, but from listeners as well, who've been firing in questions all day today. Some really interesting ones. We'll get to them later on. But tell us, a year ago, we met not too far from here, and you were about to head off to Girona. I think you were almost en route to Girona when we met you. You're about to head back there for your second season as a senior. Tell us a little bit about what your plans are for the winter and also for next season. Do you know what your I know your team has changed. What's happening with that at the moment?
Going back to Girona, which is really nice to be returning to a familiar base, and kind of knowing how everything works, and although it's a different flat I'm moving into, it's still the same place and a lot of the same faces and stuff, which is nice. And obviously just the training and the weather there is pretty good, so it's a nice mix in Girona. I like the culture and the Catalan people and everything. And then after the winter, I'll be cracking on with the season again, and already looking forward to getting back racing. And the team's changing up a little bit. We've got a new name and some new sponsors on board, but predominantly it'll be pretty much the same program as Axel's run for the last 5 or 6 years now.
That's Axel Merckx, of course. Tell us a bit about life in Girona, because I think a lot of people have this idea, this sense of Girona as this real kind of hub of professional cycling, which it has become, and a lot of pros live there. Is it a place where you just go down to the square in the morning and bump into any number of pros? Do you see a lot of the other guys who do live there, the sort of more established professionals? Do you train with them? What's it like? Is it the Girona that a lot of cycling fans imagine?
I think it's very different in the winter to the summer, and I can't really comment on the summer because I've not actually spent any time there in the summer. I was just there last winter, kind of up until the end of February. But certainly in the winter, it's very different to the perception that most cycling fans and journalists and riders have of Girona being like a real hub of cycling with kind of, I don't know, 70, 80 professional riders there, I think. But it's a lot more low-key. I think there's maybe 10, maybe maximum 15 guys that base themselves there through the winter. And yeah, you do see quite a lot of those guys, and it becomes a nice little group, or certainly was last year. And I really like training with more experienced guys. I think you can learn a lot, especially in kind of December, January, where everyone's a little bit more relaxed. You can pick up quite a lot from casual conversations and just generally, you know, meet some really interesting people.
What ones have you... I know you spent a bit of time training with David Miller last winter. I don't think he'll be training all that hard this winter, sadly. But any other riders, Dan Martin or anybody like that, who you've been training with while you've been there?
Yeah, Dan and even Dan's dad, Neil, who still rides quite a lot, who is British champion. But certainly riding with Dan a lot. Matt Bramier, Paul Voss, Eric Rousel, the Yates brothers have moved to Girona.
Hastings still live there?
I've never ridden with Hastings. Christian Mayer on Canadian on Orica lives there. There's quite a few guys. I think Dan McClay was talking about moving there, who's British, just turned pro. And there's a few other guys. So it's not so much the people that are there. It's just I speak fairly reasonable Spanish, although it's not the language of choice in Catalonia. It's still easier to get by, but it's just a nice culture. It's pretty laid back. The traffic, touch wood, is always really good, which is a big thing for me. It's you get a feeling of a lot more safety than you do, or than I certainly feel riding in the UK or or in some other European country. So
what's the actual riding like, the terrain, and are you able to mix it up?
Yeah, certainly. I think a lot of people, I know some guys have gone there and been disappointed with the riding, like they expect like a real amazing riding just because the amount of guys that live there, but I actually quite liked it for the winter because it wasn't kind of constantly huge climbs. It's quite a nice variation. There's enough climbing certainly to be done, but it's not just up and downhill. There's flat roads, there's rolling roads, which I quite like, kind of similar to Britain. Quite a few of my early season races are a little bit more rolling than mountainous, so I think that's important, and it's nice just to mix it up. And yeah, there's a really good variation. You can always head to the coast when the weather's bad and stuff like that. Whereas, I mean, I've trained in Nice before, which is another big haven around Monaco and Nice, and I really liked it, but the thing I didn't like was the fact that the coastal road was the only real kind of road away from the mountains, and it was really, really busy with traffic, and that was it. It was just the coastal road. So
what do you do when you're back here in London? You live, you know, East London, basically, North East London. So where do you actually get out to?
Out through where the Tour de France went this year, actually, the reverse. So the painting's still on the road, which is pretty funny. So out through Epping Forest, and then either occasionally out into Hertfordshire or mainly into into Essex, which is, it's not great. I think there's something like 35 traffic lights before I get out to the countryside. Obviously it's pretty flat, but it makes you certainly appreciate when you go somewhere nice for training. And I kind of purposefully did about 2 weeks here, just because when you do get to somewhere really great for training, you certainly appreciate it.
With all those traffic lights, you could do what Sean Kelly did, which was use them for kind of intervals, so slow down for one, stop, and then sprint away from everyone.
I haven't tried that one yet, but it's not the end of the world for this time of year. And like I say, I used to have to go out after school and stuff in the dark down Newbridge Road, and even, you know, was doored by a minicab when I was 13 or 14 on Newbridge Road. So it makes you appreciate going to live somewhere like Spain, where you can be out on lanes in a few minutes.
Semi-serious question. No, it is a serious question. It's not going to sound like it, but in places like Girona, so many gap year and Erasmus students like yourself, no, cyclists who live there, is there a danger if someone is vulnerable to, you know, perhaps losing concentration, perhaps going out a lot? There are always people to socialise with, and there are some guys that have gone to those kind of training hubs and it hasn't worked for them because there's always someone to do an easy ride or a coffee stop or go out on the lash in the evening. You've got to be quite careful.
Yeah, I wouldn't even know where to go out in Girona, to be honest. Really? I think there's a nightclub there, but I've never seen it.
Yeah, right.
No, seriously, I'm deadly serious.
Was that here?
I am.
You're going for the Marcel Kittel hairstyle there.
Right, but I'm deadly serious. For me personally, I'd like to stick to the training that I've planned, and I think the guys that I have trained there with in the winter are, on the whole, really good guys to train with. And you can always, you know, go slightly easier than you plan and do slightly longer. So I like to be reasonably flexible with my training, and I think 90% of the time it's better to be a little bit more social and enjoy your training a little bit, because it's a long winter. I don't really start racing until quite late than a lot of guys, and I think that's something you learn more and more as you grow up, is just like not to be too nervous in these first few months of the winter and just build into it.
You had an injury this year that kept you sidelined for a while, and I guess that's probably a dangerous time, a vulnerable time. I think you came back to London, didn't you, to have the injury treated? It was after Tour of California.
Yeah, it was, I was back in London, mainly just because I couldn't ride or I couldn't really walk or move around even for a couple of weeks, so while we were trying to work out what was wrong. But dangerous time
in the sense that you can't train, so you know boredom can set in, and you can become distracted. You might have ventured into that Girona nightclub had you been there. Dare I suggest?
I think certainly it was good to be back in London and try to be a little distracted from the injury, just because otherwise you just get too bogged down if you've got nothing else to think about. But
there are no nightclubs in London anyway, are there? So no, that's convenient.
You can't go out in London.
We have got you in a brewery here.
Yeah, we
couldn't organise a podcast in a brewery, but you're drinking tea. We're happy to report, just in case anyone out there is concerned that you might have gone off the rails a little bit. You are drinking tea. Now, Theo, you were third at Liège Bastogne Liège this year, first year as a senior, not senior Liège Bastogne Liège, but under 23 Liège Bastogne Liège. You were 15th at the Tour of Britain. You rode very well at the Tour of California as well. Last year you were up there in Paris-Roubaix, Junior Paris-Roubaix. What kind of rider are you?
I have no idea, to be honest. Certainly, I think I've learned that like the harder the race, and also the longer the race, the more it suits me. So the stage into Brighton, which didn't end so well, but I was actually on the attack between the two KOMs, and then obviously again at the end, maybe with a little more thinking, could have gone better.
You took a flyer in that stage.
But that was the longest race of my career anyway, and I think it certainly felt like it suited me. And similar with Liège, it was like a real wearing down process.
How long is under 23 Liège Bastogne Liège?
It's not that long. It's 190k, I think, 189k, but it's just kind of undulating roads all day, 2-3 kilometer climbs, no real flat roads, just up and down, up and down, up and down. And it's one of those races where you get to about 30k to go and you look around and there's only 40 guys left, of which 10 are hanging on, or 50 guys, 20 hanging on, and all of a sudden it feels like a kind of easy to be up the front compared to at the start, where it's a real fight. I certainly like those races. I think Roubaix Juniors was almost just similar to that. It's just a wearing down process.
Is that because obviously the distances go up when you turn senior, so has that been quite a revelation for you this year to find out that you do excel in those longer, tougher races?
I'd always kind of suspected it, because even as an under 16, I'd always preferred the longer races. Obviously the limit was something like 70 or 80k, and again at juniors we never raced more than 120, but I always enjoyed and preferred those longer races. I mean, the Tour L'Avenir, the last 2 days were 100k, and I didn't particularly enjoy those stages. I didn't feel like they were playing to my strengths, especially at the time coming off of my injury. I didn't really manage to do any top end in the back half of the season until kind of after the Tour of Britain. So I certainly didn't feel like those really short punchy races kind of played to my advantage. But then they were going up 3 coals and they still took like 3.5 hours. So it's,
in case anybody doesn't realise that Tour of Britain, you were 15th overall. But people will remember, obviously, the incident on the stage to Brighton, which is on YouTube.
He made a bid to reintroduce a Superman position to cycling.
Very good, yeah. It was Graeme O'Brien-esque. You took a flyer, you attacked, you were off the front, but you misjudged the corner slightly, and there were several interesting camera angles on that crash. Went into the barriers. It is a miracle that you didn't hurt yourself.
Yeah, I think I had a few broken ribs.
Really?
I was in quite a lot of pain. It actually didn't start until a week later, but I woke up exactly a week later, and it wasn't bad, but you know, just kind of coughing and stuff like that, sneezing.
Did that affect your Worlds then?
I don't think so.
No.
I don't know what happened at Worlds, to be honest. I think the Brighton stage and the experience between Tour of Britain and Worlds was kind of a similar thing. It's like the first time. So the individual stage was like the first time that I'd been at the front of a pro bike race and able to animate, and actually had kind of suppressed that feeling, because it up the Ditchling Beacon, I was thinking, oh, all right, they all must be waiting for something. It was a bit of a headwind, so I think probably were, but I was like, okay, I could go, but I almost didn't trust myself to go, because you don't really expect to be in that situation. So the first time it happens is a bit of the unknown. And then I made the decision to attack on the flat between the two KOMs when it kind of eased up, which in hindsight wasn't a great decision, because I think there was 3 or 4 Saxos behind and they started chasing. So I got caught halfway up the second KOM, which turned out to be quite a lot harder than anyone had realised. but I still managed to hang on, and then was in the position at the end to just, I know that a sprint isn't going to be my forte, so I just give it a pop. And okay, I ended up just going a bit too quick, really. But it was one of those things where the first time you're in that situation, you don't really know what to expect.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney, and Daniel Freen.
Okay, we're here in Hackney with Tao Geoghegan-Hart, who's joining us. We'll do a little chat here about what else is going on in the cycling world, and then come back and throw some of your questions to Tao. It's a bit of a quiet time in cycling at the moment, but a wee bit of news. Matthias Brändli, the Austrian rider who was a bit of a revelation at the Tour of Britain this year, won two stages, and he set a new world record last week, beating Jens Voigt's recent record. Not as much interest perhaps in Brändli's performance, given that for Voigt it was a swan song, bang out. I know that Tao has a good Jens Voigt story you can maybe share with us later on, having got to know him at the Tour of California. But Brändli, what did you? I know you're a big fan of sitting watching the Our Record, Lionel. Did you watch that?
Brändli almost sounds like what New York marketing guy would call the first British winner of the Tour de France.
He would. He might. He might.
What would U.S. marketing guy think of the Our Record anyway?
As it goes on too long. Make it 20 minutes.
Brilliant. And Lionel, bringing you back in, Lionel. Now, did you watch it? Did it sort of penetrate?
Yeah, I watched the last 20 minutes. No, I didn't. I did watch it all. It was at the UCI's track, Aigle, which is 200 meters long, I think, rather than the more standard 250. All sorts of aerodynamic and physics related implications of that, I gather. Quite a bit harder at that speed to keep down on the banking when, you know, hugging the black line is the key, because that's where the measurement is taken. And I think at 50, close to 52k an hour, quite takes its toll, I think, towards the end.
What is the consensus about that? I mean, there's a massive variation in terms of length of velodromes. I remember when Sosenka broke it in, when was that, 2007? That was in Moscow, wasn't it? It's a 330 meter track, I think.
333.
Yeah, and compare that to, like you say, the Eglin track. I mean, it seems like a huge distance for someone who, the uninitiated, as far as track racing is concerned, it seems like there would be a big disparity. No?
Well, yeah, I'm not an expert. Rob Hales has talked to me about this until my eyes went a bit crossed. I couldn't really keep up with the theory, but there's all sorts of, you know, the entering and exiting the banking. Basically, you get a sort of slingshot effect that you can take advantage of if you're a seasoned track rider, and that was one of his sort of big skills. And one of the things he tried to teach younger riders was how to take advantage of the track. Now, Brändli is not necessarily a renowned track rider, but he did look like he was well up on Voigt's mark for quite a long time, and then in the last 15 minutes or so he faded quite a lot. It was never in doubt that he was going to break it, but it was quite interesting. It'd be interesting to see if one of the bigger names would take the risk of going on a 200 metre track. I suspect they probably wouldn't.
I think it gives us a good sense of how good Jens Voigt's performance was, where it stacks up in the grand scheme of things. Brändli is a young, strong rider, very good time trialist, but not among the sort of top four or five in the world. So certainly the Our Record is there for the taking. Be interested to see it on the Ghent track. I know you're going to the Ghent 6 soon, Lionel. It's about 160 metres, isn't it, the Ghent track? Very short.
It's like the wall of death in there. I'm not sure that would be ideal for an hour record attempt.
You get dizzy.
You might do. I mean, they have Madison chases that go on for 20-25 minutes, and they do, the riders then ask them to walk the opposite way round in a circle. They just can't do it. They fall down. It's ridiculous.
But just on the advantages and disadvantages of the small track, I guess it's a similar argument to the issue of altitude. And Eddie Merckx famously broke the hour record in 1972 in Mexico. But, you know, you speak to experts. I remember speaking to Chris Boardman about this at some length, that the trade-off there was pretty equal in terms of, you know, the air pressure is lower at altitude, so you can, in theory, go faster because of that. But then it's also harder to breathe. and it was a fairly, like I say, a fairly equal kind of trade-off.
Well, we're up in Manchester at the Velodrome next week, aren't we? So we can ask somebody there. Maybe Rob will be there to talk us through exactly the implications of riding on a shorter track. Teo, we've lost you. Track racing, does it excite you?
Go for their record.
I like this guy.
Well, I rode the Track Worlds last year. Right. So. No, it's in Glasgow, which they thought was going to be a fast track, but I think has transpired to not be so fast. It's not particularly lost on me, because when you're riding it, you can feel it, but I don't understand the physics and the seemingly very, very small, minute differences in each track that does make one track quicker than another, because none of them are identical, whatever the length. I mean, certainly the Moscow one, I know that when the junior worlds were there, the times haven't been broken since. I think there was like a 4:05 Australian team pursuit, which is not too far off kind of senior pace. So I don't know too much about it, but I certainly know it does make a huge difference.
Teo Boss set a 200-meter flying world record in Moscow several years ago, which did stand for quite a long time. Which is interesting, because over such a limited distance, there'd been the riding around the bend would be sort of minimised, obviously.
No, but then the banking is twice as high to drop down from.
Ah, okay. Good knowledge. Yeah, so you get more of a flying effort, obviously, a bit more speed. Interesting. Let's move on to something else. Well, actually, before we do, we should say as well that there's talk of a women's hour record, which is not an event that's really been attempted or captured people's imagination till now, but I think Brendley's effort and new mark got people talking about where this it has captured people's imagination again, the hour record now, and obviously there's talk of a women's hour record, several candidates for that, I would think.
Well, Yvonne McGregor held that in 96, didn't she, the women's hour record. I'm not sure who holds it now, I'm afraid, don't know a bit, but in my defence
that tells its own story, doesn't it?
Well, it does, and there's no real reason why there shouldn't be an equally competitive contest in the women's hour record. It's an even blanker sheet of paper for a sort of real contest to grow. But I think with Brandley doing the men's hour record so soon after Voigt, and rather than, say, Tony Martin or Bradley Wiggins or Fabian Cancellara going straight in and putting it a little bit out of reach for most people, it's good, because this saga's going to run and run. We'll you know, when the season starts to die down next year, there may be riders going for it on, like in the early 90s or near the mid-90s, 93, 94, when O'Brien and Boardman were pretty much going for it, you know, one after the other.
Yeah, I mean, I think with the mark that Brandley's set, it does still feel as though it's low-hanging fruit to an extent. They're not the absolute best time trialists or track riders who have set those records, Voigt and Brandley, but yeah, who knows? We might see the ante being upped by the likes of Tony Martin, Cancellara and Wiggins in the next few months.
Well, the Women's World Hour record is held by Szilárd van Moorsel. Leontien Szilárd van Moorsel, who's the great Dutch rider, now retired. She set, what's the unified UCI world record there? 46.065 kilometres an hour. So that's the mark that would have to be beaten.
Van Moorsel was the sort of Marianne Vos of her day. Very, very versatile, and a real all-rounder. Let's talk about some other news this last week. Bobby Julich and Sean Yates to Tinkoff Saxo, both kind of going back to that team, both have been there. Julich as a rider, and Yates as a DS a few years ago at Saxo Bank. Yates in particular, I mean, he left Sky a couple of years ago. He was retiring from the sport, and he returned this year with NFTO team and is back at World Tour level. Difficult to know what to make of that, really, Lionel.
Yes, it is. Thanks for that slightly warm potato there, Richard. yes, it is. I mean, we know that Sean Yates retired very soon after Bradley Wiggins had won the Tour de France. There were stories in the national press. This was around the time that Sky were having their zero tolerance policy re-looked at, weren't they? They were reiterated, re-emphasised, and people began leaving the team at around about the time that they were being asked to say they'd never had any involvement in doping. Daniel.
Well, they've hired, I mean, the team has hired three new DSs. The third one is Patchy Vila, who rode for Lamprey and tested positive for testosterone during his career. So, however many mitigating circumstances there were with Julik and well, Yates to a lesser extent, but Julik left Sky under a cloud, having confessed to his own doping, and then Patchy Vila coming on board. Perhaps from that point of view, the people will raise eyebrows, but also... it's quite rare to see such turnover in the staff of a team. And, you know, most of these pro teams, and they have a bit of a cliquey feel about them, the sort of group of DSs. It's a group of, certainly with the French and the Italian teams and the Spanish teams, a group of guys who often rode together when they were pros and have sort of stayed together as four or five DSs. And they're not really held accountable for results. And, you know, they tend to stay there for year after year after year. And it's interesting that, you know... Tinkov got rid of two this year. Fabrizio Guidi is gone, and Philippe Mordui, the French DS, who was really the senior DS there, always in the first team car when Contador was riding, very, very highly rated, very respected, and he has been sort of elbowed out of the way. And I just wonder how much of this is coming from Tinkov himself, the kind of pressure that he puts on his team to perform and get results, and how hands-on he is.
It's an interesting one, and there is a sense as well, they've hired so many people from Sky that, you know, they're eager to learn whatever lessons there are to learn from that team. Tinkov has often spoken about wanting to really take on Sir Brailsford, as he calls him, and prove that they're the number one team instead of Sky.
And Sky, of course, have hired a physiologist from Movistar this year. So this kind of exchange of knowledge, expertise between the so-called big four now in major tours, you know, Quintana being the big rider from Movistar, kind of continues. When we think about that sort of brain trust that Tinkov have taken from Sky, Tinkov now have Chris Froome, two of Chris Froome's former DSs. They've got Sean Yates and Stephen de Jong. And they've also got his former coach, Bobby Julik, so they know pretty much everything they need to know about Chris Froome. All they need now is Michelle Cound, as the, I think as someone said on Twitter, as the team nutritionist.
Michael Rogers as well is there, yeah. Of course. Nicholas Roach has gone the other way, so... Oh yeah, Astana. So Astana are still... We've spoken about Astana a couple of times. There's this little cloud hanging over Astana, and I think you were on the phone earlier, Daniel, to our good friend Ciro Scognamiglio, who of course is closer to Vincenzo Nibali than Nibali's own wife. And what's his sort of insight into what's going on at Astana and Nibali's situation there?
It was a quite bereft sounding Ciro, because Nibali's on holiday at the moment, and I don't think they've seen each other for a few days, so Ciro was sounding slightly crestfallen, like a dog without a bone. Anyway, Ciro was talking to me about the Grand Tours next year. There's obviously a lot of debate about who is going to do what, whether it's going to be Aru at the Giro and Nibali at the Tour, or whether they're both going to do both races supporting each other, vice versa. Ciro's feeling is that Nibali will probably miss the Giro now, and it will be Aru will be the captain there, and that they will both do the Tour de France, so Aru as Nibali's understudy, which obviously will be interesting.
Now, one of the thing that has cast a cloud over Astana provoked this UCI investigation into Astana and questions over whether they'll be given their license, was three positive tests, two for the Glinski brothers, Maxime and Valentin, and a young under-23 rider, David Enoch, who's with the Astana under-23 team. He tested positive at the Tour de l'Avenir, which you were riding, Teo. I mean, what's your, when you hear something like that, and it was a serious doping offence, it was steroids, I believe, in his case. What I mean, how do you react to hearing something like that?
It was certainly interesting, because I think it was the first rider that I've raced against who's tested positive in a race that I was competing in. So that's certainly like an interesting feeling, I guess, because when it's races that you're not in, I guess it's kind of different to someone that you're actually racing against. I think it's just kind of, as a rider, you just, as a clean rider, you're just sad to see that happen, I think, especially in races that you're racing, and you just hope that there's not a lot of other guys doing that, because I don't think there's a place for it in the sport, and I hope there isn't a place for it in the sport. So I just think it's a shame that however he's ended up kind of going down that road, that it's happened. And
to me, you feel angry?
I think at the time, yeah, a little bit. I mean, if I'd been, say, second on the stage that he won, I think, you know, that's a real different ball game. But certainly, yeah, it makes you just kind of, I think you have to be careful not to question performances and just trust in these tests and hope that they do catch guys, whether it's at the time or retrospectively, and you just concentrate on yourself.
Just generally, Toe, can you talk us through the kind of testing that you undergo in under 23 level? What kind of, is there any blood profiling? How many tests roughly you took last year? Is it statutory after every race, the top three? You know, what happens under 23 level?
Well, it's different every race, which is important to bear in mind. I've only done one blood test, which was at the Tour of California, where USADA took a new stance, I guess, in creating mini blood profiles for all of the riders at the Tour of California. I think it was only the Americans that they created a profile for, so they had one or two tests before the Tour of California, regardless of who they were, all the Americans. I don't know if this was published, actually. And then everyone else just had a blood test at the start of the race. So that was the first time I'd had a blood test. In juniors, it was pretty common that it would be either the winner or the top three in the UCI races, and then also two randoms.
Just urine testing.
That's right. Yeah. So in juniors, I was tested when I was on the podium of Paris-Roubaix. That was my first anti-doping test. Then again, when I won in Croatia, I was tested three times there. And also again in Luigi-Giano, I was tested every day when I was leading the race and in the top three of stages.
It doesn't sound particularly robust. I mean, does that worry you slightly that you know, when you think about the amount of testing there is at pro level, it's not uncommon for people to be tested 50, 60, 70 times a year, blood and urine combined. So to go from being maybe tested a handful of times, you know, to think that pro teams are looking at that level and that's where they're taking riders from, often I suppose the onus is on the teams themselves to do a lot of background checks, because the UCI tests and the tests they're getting in races aren't really enough of a guarantee. Would you agree with that?
I think the testing procedure in the juniors is good, personally. I think it's just it's unlogical to do, you know, like a massive biological passport or something like that when it doesn't exist at continental. I think to implicate that in the juniors would just be a step too far, because there's guys coming out of the kind of undergrowth all the time, and that's kind of that's what happens in you know, development sport. Young guys kind of mature at different times and they come to that level at different times. So I think the fact that they're testing guys in the top three and doing random tests, for me, I think that's pretty good. And for me, I always looked at the testing more as, if you want to be a professional rider, you need to get used to going through those procedures, because for a rider it can be quite disruptive. You need to be ready to produce a urine sample, you need to know the whole procedure of the test, where you're opening different boxes and everything has seals, all the numbers have to match. It's quite a stringent process, which I think a lot of people don't realise that. So certainly I think the fact that there is testing is really good, because it means riders get used to going through those procedures and working out how it kind of works with all the officials and UCI doctors and stuff like that. I think there's enough testing.
Yeah, I mean, at junior level, the riders who are going to catch the eye of bigger teams and progress are the ones that are winning and getting on the podiums, aren't they? So
yeah,
they're the ones.
I mean, as long as the tests themselves for the, you know, first three finishes are for EPO, for example, and, you know, heavy duty substances, and yeah, I mean, but we all know how easy it is to cheat. You know, when you know that there are going to be tests after races rather than out of competition, and which can come at any time, it is fairly easy to time your doses. I mean, I'm not speaking from personal experience, but
Just because they're junior races, I mean, they test for all the proper, you know, all the mainstream substances, you know, the major substances. They don't just test for Calpol or, you know, anidine.
EPO, they don't always test for EPO in even at pro level. Not all of the tests are for EPO, so, you know, and that is the probably the most important test. So you know, you can almost, the rest of the stuff is almost a waste of time.
So it's just an excuse to make a joke, really. It wasn't a pop at you, Daniel.
Well, speaking of EPO, we were at the London Sports Writing Festival last week, and there were a few interesting people there. There was a lot of cycling events. Christophe Basson was there. You spent a lot of time with him, Daniel. How was Christophe Basson?
Yeah, he was good. He's got a new job on a sort of Franco-Spanish task force patrolling the French-Spanish border. Quite interesting. Anti-doping authorities, which was very interesting. Spoke to him about how, you know, the kind of modus operandi in that group, that task force, and he was telling me about how they have the authority to put people on wiretaps and, you know, send guys into gyms with wires and get the name of people, particularly suspicious looking characters who float into gyms who have gained a lot of muscle in the last few weeks, and they tap their phones. And yeah, it was quite interesting. Obviously something that he's sort of relishing, being so hands-on in terms of sort of stopping supply lines of drugs between those two countries.
Well, Emma O'Reilly was also there. She's Lance Armstrong's former soigneur and has written a book that came out this year, and a sort of memoir of her time working with US Postal and Armstrong. And it's there are a lot of books obviously about Armstrong and about that period, but hers is a bit different and interesting because she paints quite a nuanced picture of Armstrong, and you know, actually Armstrong writes a foreword to her book, so there's been a real sort of reconciliation there. And I spoke to her just for a few minutes after her event just to find out what the reaction had been to her book and where she's at the moment. Here's Emma O'Reilly.
Actually, it's been really, really positive. There's very, very little negativity, but most people are actually quite enjoying the fact that nuanced is how it's been described, that it's just, I've kind of put the information out there and kind of given a different angle to, because it's the whole thing was a story about human beings and human beings away from home and kind of half how we behave away from home and the decisions we were all faced with, and that nothing is quite black and white, because I think that's been one of the things about all the whole stories about Lance and stuff. They're all black and white, but none of us are black and white. There's shades of grey in everything.
Would you have written quite a different book 10 years ago?
Yeah, well, firstly, no one wanted me to write the book, and I wouldn't have probably written a book, but yeah, 10 years ago I would have written a completely different book, yeah, because it would have been more about the problems that cycling's experiencing, and obviously myself and Lance had the fallout by then.
And I mean, you know, you gained sort of fame, notoriety by being a whistleblower. You were one of the first people to come out who'd been part of that inner circle at US Postal. You were one of the first people to come out and tell the truth about what happened. That must have been a very lonely place to be at times.
Yeah, well, it was really. But I think really what made it lonely was kind of being sued and all the kind of stress and all of that you're kind of being sued. You've brought this so much trouble to your doorstep, and really nothing good had come of it. And I think that's, so you meant I kind of questioned everything I did, because I tried to do something right and no good had come out of it, you know. So yeah, it wasn't a good time.
And you met Armstrong about a year ago, so after his downfall. You went over to the States and met him, and what were your impressions of him? Did you feel he'd changed?
Yeah, no, if you know what I mean, because I don't think any of us changed, but I think he definitely matured and kind of was learning, was still in the process of learning from the experience, you know. And yet in other ways, it was the old Lance, but the Lance I met who'd just come back from cancer, who was kind of quite a humble human being, kind of a decent fella you'd sit and have a coffee with, you know what I mean? So that was the Lance that I met again a year ago, that one who life had kind of been hard on him and brought him back to reality.
So you felt that his, because a lot of people obviously are sceptical over whether he's genuinely humble, whether he's putting it on. Were you convinced that, that there was sort of genuine contrition on his part?
Yeah, I wouldn't have went over if I thought I was just being... But, and even still, the trust wasn't there, which is why I took a journalist with me, because just in case, because I thought if he's being genuine, well, let's get it out there. But if he's not being genuine, I'm going to slaughter him. Do you know what I mean? Mm. But no, I think he was genuine. But it took us 10, 11 months before we got to that stage. Mm. So we'd kind of...
Yeah, you'd been in touch quite a lot, hadn't you? And since then, have you kept in close contact with him?
Yeah, just in contact this week. Mm-hmm. So yeah, no, he's stayed in touch.
And what? You know. Any plans? Do you meet up or do you chat, or is it just by text?
Mostly by email and text and stuff like that. Yeah, no more plans to meet up, because in a sense, our lives. Yeah, we get on. There'll always be a connection. There's always a shared history, but our lives and ways have nothing in common. And I don't really want to have, I want a nice, quiet, simple life. Do you know what I mean?
How would you say? Because you were working cycling for quite a while. You came in through the Irish national team initially through Alistair McLennan, I think was the performance director at the time, Irish cycling. Yeah. And you know, you were, I suppose, you know, it would be understandable if you felt quite scarred, quite bruised by your experiences working in cycling. But what do you feel? Towards cycling now?
Do you know, it's still a great sport. I still love it and I still love watching it, and I still think there's no other athletes like them, because recently the sport's got such a bad name that people are forgetting these lads have got to train, they've got to go out in the rain, they suffer. It's a great sport. So, but if you'd asked me that question two, maybe 3 years ago, no, I wasn't watching bike racing. I'd just been sickened. Mm. So I've kind of, and I just got a bike and all that, so I've just really done the full circle.
So you've reconnected.
I have reconnected.
Would you work in cycling again?
I don't think so, no.
No come and get me plea there to any teams.
No. Actually, too, those long days and slapping bags around and checking in and being standing there in the cold with feed bags, no. Doesn't appeal.
I mean, another part, obviously, when people talk about your book, there's a huge focus on the Lance Armstrong stuff and the doping stuff, but it's also a fascinating insight into being a soigneur. And was that your intention as well?
It was a bit, really what I wanted was, I didn't want it to kind of be a sports book. I wanted it to be a human story, and like, here's what happens. And yeah, in a sense, nothing much happens being a soigneur. You kind of get up, you have breakfast, you go to a bike race, you finish the bike race, you rub a few legs, you do a bit of laundry, and the same every single day. But people think it's kind of some mystical things. No, it's not.
Just hard work.
Just hard work, yeah. But once you're organised, the work isn't as hard, you know.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Emma. What's your next book?
No, there's no other book. There's no other book ever again.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
Okay, we're back here with Teo Gegenhart. Teo, we're going to ask you a few questions now that have been submitted by some of our listeners. Some good ones. No, don't peek at them now, please. You know, that's cheating. Right, here's the first one from Moeen Islam. How much of a consideration for young riders is it whether a trade team has GC, stage hunting or classics aspirations? Is the career path preordained? Oh, sorry, I missed the last bit. And if Lionel could ask this as US marketing guy. Sorry, I missed that. But he's talking here about, obviously, when it comes to turning pro, which hopefully you will do at some point in the future. What would influence your choice of team?
I guess that's kind of a bridge that you cross when you get to it, from my perspective. But certainly I don't think there's many teams now that are really specifically one kind of type of cycling or part of that kind of calendar, whether it's classics or grand tours. I think even if you look at those real strong sprint teams, they all have GC leaders and climbers in there. So I think maybe that's kind of a different era of cycling, whether that's influenced by points or different outlook on marketing or whatever, I don't know. But I'm sure US marketing guy will have a...
Hey, kid, the first thing, the name. You got to change the name. Teo Gegenhart. No one in Idaho is going to pronounce that. What's wrong with Tom Hart, for goddamn sake?
Tom Hart. Tom? Teo.
Interestingly, Teo means Tom in Irish Gaelic.
Yeah, of course it does. I know that. Don't try to teach me to suck eggs, kid.
I guess you may have Irish heritage being...
Oh, brilliant. Excellent. But you're right, you're right. If you look at a team like Giant Shimano, have obviously the sprint operation around Kittel, but it's actually proving to be quite a good development team for a guy like Warren Barguil, who can ride the Vuelta as leader.
Yeah, I mean, they've got three or four young guys in there who are predominantly GC guys. Lawson Craddock is another one, am I right? Who, and they do get a lot of freedom. They kind of get a free roll in a lot of races. I was talking to Ben Swift about this a couple of weeks ago, you know, about the way Sky develop or don't develop young riders, and he did admit that at Katusha, which is of course where he started his pro career, he would often go in to races and he would literally have a free roll. They would say to him, look, just see how your legs are today and we'll make the decision on the road. And he says at Sky that there is never a race where you don't have a job to do for someone.
Okay, Tim Print asks, have you met Axel's dad yet? That's Eddie.
No, I haven't, and I'd really, really love to, actually. I was injured during Paris-Roubaix when I would have... Paris-Roubaix Espoir under 23, when I would have met Axel and... Eddie, and I would really love to meet Eddie.
If you do, Tail, do tell me you're a good friend of Daniel Freeb, the author of an unauthorised biography of Eddie Merckx, with which he may be familiar.
Unfortunately, I think he is familiar, yep.
How's that fat one?
Did he not like it?
No, I heard he sort of softened to it. He hated it before he'd read it, and there were all sorts of vague legal threats in the air. But then I was led to believe that he had actually finally read it and quite liked it.
Daniel, it's an excellent book. It's the definitive Eddie Merckx biography, as well as William Fotheringham's, of course. It's the best non-Fotheringham authored biography of Eddie Merckx.
The co-definitive.
Okay, here are linked questions here. Duncan Watkins asks, well, he asked two questions. The first one was, which is better for travelling, Bali or Phuket? But I think that was a tongue-in-cheek question. Duncan Watkins asks, seriously though, how does development in North America differ to the experience of British cycling development? And Joe Hill also asks, what lessons could the US scene have for young rider development in Europe?
I don't know how well placed I am to comment on US cycling development, which obviously doesn't personally affect me, but I guess I've seen it through teammates and they look after their riders incredibly well. Obviously it's a long way from home. It's a huge expense even just to travel to Europe, and those guys stay long stints in Holland at the USA Cycling facility, and it seems like they have a great program. The second part of the question was, what could they learn?
What lessons could learn?
I mean, certainly there's a lot of support, and there seems to be a lot of financial and equipment support in the States. I guess there's a lot of big business there, and there's a lot of big cycling brands in America, and they seem to have a lot of development teams. I guess sometimes my impression of the American domestic scene was, the only thing I didn't particularly like was the distance of races were all quite short. And obviously, as I've kind of alluded to earlier, I don't really like that style of racing, but it also, I found, was very different to European racing. I haven't done all of the American domestic races, but I did a few, and that was kind of my takeaway point, was that they just seemed very different in style and particularly length to European races.
Taylor, just on that, I was chatting to Charlie Wegelius, the Garmin direct sportif, recently, and he said that a lot of the young American guys that turn pro are lacking in the skills department, because the strongest guys at under 23 and junior level over there, a lot of the races are on very wide roads, small groups, and they can very, very easily move around the bunch, so they don't really have the skills that like the Belgians, the Italians and stuff develop. Would you agree?
Yeah, 100%. Not specifically that there are... I mean, I've seen that for sure, yeah. Yeah, I guess, yeah. The roads are huge, and if you're racing down a 3-4-lane highway, you can be at the front of a 150-man bunch in 15 seconds if you want. And there's also a lot less that causes that kind of carnage you would expect in races, like road furniture and roundabouts and all the rest of it. They're non-existent. So in our program, we have a discussion and a dialogue about that, and that includes making sure that we do race in Europe, because it's a big skill, and we're lucky because we get to do those big pro races like California that not many development teams get to do, and Utah and Colorado and Alberta, which is big learning for us and also big exposure when it does go well. But we also have the under 23 Nations Cups in Europe, and I've had certainly enough racing in Europe that I feel like I've got a good mix.
Douglas Ryder said the same thing about the African riders, actually, that the roads there can be sort of 50 kilometres long without a bend, and that skills acquisition just doesn't happen if that's the kind of racing or the kind of riding you're exposed to. A very blunt question here from Joe Salmon on Facebook. Have you ever been offered doping products?
Nope.
Not before this afternoon, before he arrived.
That's just a cup of tea, I think. But no, there's a no.
No.
No. It's maybe unfair to put this question to you, but Scott Nodding asks, does Sky Pro Cycling help or hinder the development of young British cycling talent? It might be a bit unfair to put that to you at this stage, Teo, but Daniel, you've been working, I think, on a story on this very subject, haven't you?
Yeah, I've just written a fairly sizable piece on this. I think it's coming out in the next couple of weeks in Pro Cycling. I think, you know, Sky's have got a poor record with young riders, just in terms of victories. I mean, there's a statistic in my piece that I think there are five riders currently born in the 90s on Sky's roster. In 10 seasons between them at that team, they've won, I think, one race. Sky had no riders born in the 1990s that got a UCI World Tour point last year. So, you know, it doesn't look great on paper. I think they've done okay with the British riders. They are the ones who have progressed. The Stannards, the Luke Rowe is doing pretty well. There are a couple that have slipped through the net. Josh Edmondson is going to leave the team at the end of this year, and it hasn't really worked out for him there, but they are very aware that they haven't catered for the sort of developmental needs of a lot of riders, not just British riders, because they're so focused on the Grand Tours, and particularly, you know, Chris Froome and the Tour de France. So, you know, it's actually quite hard with World Tour obligations and sponsors' obligations, because they have to race in certain places to satisfy the sponsor. It's quite hard to tailor individual programs to suit young riders and to give them exposure in terms of leading teams in small races, etc. Because, you know, inevitably there will be a Froome or a Richie Porte or a Wiggins who needs guys riding and working for him.
Well, is it not like just saying that a cat doesn't bark well, or
yeah, kind of.
It's not their focus, and everyone seems to allude to this massive debate about Sky developing riders, but if that's not their focus, like you say, that's not what their sponsor's interested in, then
no. But I don't think until this point they've been explicit about it not being their focus. I think they have given the impression that it would be like a breeding ground for British riders, and well, particularly British riders, but I don't think it has been. And I think they have,
but Pete Kenner won races last year, and I think that the press seems to really love the story of Sky not developing riders, but I don't really understand the obsession with specifically Sky not developing riders, I think.
Well, because when they came along with loads of money in 2010, one of the things was not just to British rider win a tour, of course, yeah, but then to create the next generation and the next generation. And, I mean, personally, I think, you know, they get a lot of heat for not taking the Yates brothers, for example, last year. But actually, if you look at what is best for the development of the Yates brothers, it was to join another team other than Sky. And Dave Brailsford has pretty much said, he said to us on the podcast earlier this year that, you know, what they haven't really done, and you're right, they haven't focused on it. They haven't gone to races like the Circuit de la Sarthe or, you know, I don't know, put teams into small races dotted around Europe where they could say, right, Josh Edmondson, you are the team leader racing for the win. Luke Rowe, you are the team leader going for stage wins in, you know, whatever. They just haven't done that. And you're absolutely right. It's not like they set out to say that's what we're going to do and then haven't done it. They just haven't done it.
And this happens in every sport. I mean, in the piece that I've written, I've mentioned the Feyenoord, which is a Dutch football team, their sort of fated youth academy, and there've been all sorts of sort of analysis as to what it is that makes that academy so good and they've produced so many players. But the coaches themselves say that we simply have not got enough money to buy in a lot of expensive, you know, whether it be foreign talent or even Dutch talent, so therefore the young guys have to get opportunities. And it's the same in cycling. I mean, in my piece I say that La Française des Jeux, FDJ, they've had 47 race wins in the last 2 years from riders born in the 1990s. Sky have had zero. And, you know, that was is mainly two riders, Arnaud Demar and Nasser Bouhanni. But FDJ didn't have any big names, big egos, big big signings sort of clogging up that kind of path to opportunity.
So it's by necessity.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, there are more than one. There's more than one way to develop a rider as well. I mean, a rider could be developed in a domestic role. You know, a rider like Peter Kenyuk at the Tour in that lieutenant role, or Richie Port previous year, Chris Froome even before that. So there's more than. I don't think you can measure rider development purely by wins or World Tour points.
No, and if a British rider or a rider of any nationality reaches a stage where he's won loads of races for another team and suddenly the budget...
Close to it. Peter Kenyuk, 89, born in 89.
I would say he's had a pretty good season. He won Coppa Bartali, the Tour of Austria, National Championships. Might not be World Tour, but... No, Tour of Austria is World Tour.
No.
I mean,
I think there's a perception with Kenyuk that he should have got to where he has... where he is now more quickly, because this is his sixth year it's going to be at Team Sky, I think.
But he's Olympic champion.
Exactly. He took 2 years out to become Olympic champion, and he's still only, I think, 26, so there is still time. But people do expect, you know, when you compare him to, because there are more and more young riders, particularly riders born in the 90s, that are getting results very, very early in their career, and the comparison is made between them and someone like Kenyuk, and you know, you say, why has it taken 5 years to get to the point where they're even thinking about making him race leader in World Tour races?
Yeah,
I mean, he made that point himself, didn't he? You know, he said, "Believe in your riders, trust us," and you know, he wants to be given that chance. But it is extremely difficult. You know, you were making the point, Daniel, that there is a lot of focus on Sky, but what about Astana, for example? You know, they've got Fabio Aru, who's come through this year, but. You know, have they won many races with riders born in the 90s? Have Tinkoff, Saxo?
Yeah, it does tend to be confined to a couple of teams, and there are a couple of teams that are doing it very well. FDJ is one of them, Giant Shimano is another team that's doing it extremely well, and, you know, Giant Shimano seems to do very well with scouting as well, and that is one area where Sky, you know, they don't seem to have their kind of tentacles... pointed in every direction. There are certain sort of scenes, talent pools that they don't really seem to look at very hard. But then, kind of, what is the point if those first 2 years? And Dave Brailsford has always said there's no incentive in professional cycling to develop talent because there are no transfer fees. So you develop a guy for 2 years, and then if he leaves the team at the end of the his 2 years, and it's at that point that he's ready to lead the team, then what have you got out of it for those 2 years, you know?
You know, what is your plan longer term? When would you like to turn pro, ideally? Have you thought about that? I presume you have.
No. Just, for me, I prefer just to concentrate on the short term of next season and having a consistent year and kind of achieving what I feel I can. I never really felt like I... reached the kind of top form that I'd had in previous years this year, and I always felt like there was an element lacking, specifically kind of the top end in the back end of the year, and it was quite an up and down roller coaster year, so I'd like to return to how I was previously, which I felt was pretty consistent with my racing form and target some big races. And
how you say that, but you obviously moved up to senior level. How much of that sensation is due to the step up in level? I mean, you or is it a case of knowing yourself, knowing how well you're going, or measuring yourself against other guys?
I think it's very much not measuring. It's feeling how you kind of feel in yourself and in those races. I mean, our generation is lucky that we have power meters and such to kind of compare performances and look at all aspects of your physiology, but certainly I never felt like I was... The problem was that my injury was a lot to do with my left leg and losing power and sensation and feeling in my left leg and movement from a trapped nerve, and I never felt like I fully regained my left leg. Even in the Tour of Britain, Lavenir wasn't quite how I was before the injury, so that's something I'm still working on, and I hope to be back to kind of 100%.
This kid's going to be massive. He's been riding on one leg, for God's sake.
Has you got your left leg back now?
It's getting there, yeah. It's getting there.
Great. Well, Teo, thank you very much for joining us again. And hopefully you'll join us. You know, hopefully this will become an annual thing. Even when you're, you know, really big.
When he started university.
Right. Now he's... no violence, please, chaps. No, but thank you for joining us again. Hopefully you'll join us next year. Let's just think short term at the moment. Good luck with the winter. Good luck going back to Girona. Thank you. Thank you, Teo.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboo, visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.
Finally, on this week's podcast, I just want to say very sad news reached me today of the death of Alan Hewitt, who was an absolute giant in every sense of the word on the Scottish cycling scene. A real stalwart of that scene, a manager for many years of Scottish junior and senior teams, and a larger-than-life character, the funniest guy I've ever met, and he will be very sadly missed by everybody who ever met him, I think.